You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
Like I said, we have a wonderful treat for you. She is many things. She is someone who gives an incredible hug, which I've just enjoyed. She has the most amazing euro, which is a white person's afro. It's also lovely to touch. She's a mom. She's a musician. She's a politician. She's an activist. She is, and I had dots behind this on Facebook last night, because it's not her identity. It's just a fact of what she had experienced, being a survivor of predation and rape as well. She is many things. And I know that you're going to enjoy the next hour with one Jennifer Ferguson. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thank you, Eusebius, and it's beautiful to be here also and sitting in conversation with you and your great team.
It's not the same on the phone, is it?
No, absolutely.
It's lovely to hear.
There's something about the olfactory, which is exactly what we just did.
You know?
You like sniffed each other. But it's very, of course, it's part of our being animal. We're human, but we've got animal.
Of course we are.
So we can like smell each other. Like,
and you smell divine.
Yeah. You too.
I'm not very esoteric, but I love your aura.
I think it's a bit holy at the moment. I've got a few holes in it now. Holy hold.
I want to play a song. I want us to start off with a song. One of the many hats that Jennifer wears is as musician. And I wish you can go into YouTube and go and look at the official version of this song. We were all young ones, and it's a stunning video as well that goes with Bay of Bombay. The song is stunningly evocative, and I'm not going to describe it any further. I just want you to experience this, and I want you to get to know the Jennifer Ferguson. Many of you know her already. Some of you got to know her last year for the first time and have been wondering, who is she? And no better way than to just experience her through her own art.
Won't you take me away to the Bay of Bombay? I wanna lose my virtues on a yellow wave. When my eyes are sore, fingertips rub raw.
I couldn't decide whether to play that track at the end of our interview or the beginning, because one shouldn't be crying in the first 10 minutes. But what comes up for you? It is just so stunningly evocative.
Yeah, I mean, it was a kind of one of those first songs which was very pure, the source of it. It wasn't worked, you know, it just came. And of course, now I'm sitting, you know, it's a deep memory of my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose many of us, we work with this journey of accepting our parents, learning how to love them, learning sometimes that we have to be parent to our parents. And yeah, my mom was, she did the best she could. And on her deathbed, when I said thank you, you know, where I could say thank you to her and we could have, you know, deep reconciliation, the saddest thing really for me, and that summed up her life in a way, I said, thank you, Mom. You did your best.
Mm-hmm.
And she just looked at me and she just said, no, I didn't do my best. You know, and just that feeling. And I think that's a mirror for all of us in our lives. How are we living our lives? How are we using our everyday? What is really, really important?
Mm-hmm. The other thing, I mean, I listened to that track a couple of times last night in preparation for the show, is that it just brings out as well the incredible power of music and the art with which to deal with really complex psychosocial truths about ourselves as individuals and as society. I remember, for example, when I was a kid and I learned to play the piano, I didn't like it at first. I was just competitive. So I learned to play the instrument simply because other kids were doing it and I wanted attention like them.
Yeah.
By the time I finished my trick, I realized with the benefit of hindsight that in a society that tells boys in particular, you're not allowed to cry, you're not allowed to emote, a musical instrument can be a wonderful way to give expression to things that are hard to articulate. What does music do to you, and where does music fit into your entire being?
I mean, it's so important what you're naming, Eusebius, because I mean, say, you know, in Sweden where I'm living, there's a lot of kids, music, there's incredible music education as such. So you get this high level of competency and a kind of competitive thing, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And you get a lot of victims that come out of that, mm-hmm. the so-called world of affluence and plenty around arts. But there's something here when I come to South Africa and when my roots here and my journey itself also, it's this thing of being able to take your life and sing it, take what's happening to you and play it, give some shape and a conduit for what can sometimes not be reasonably explained. So the first song really that I wrote, I can say by ear, my own eyelid, was after my father's funeral when I was 9. We came back from Ermelo. It had been very traumatic. He died suddenly, heart attack, you know, all those shock things, and the kids kind of in the way of the grief. But coming back from this like efficient funeral and going to the piano and trying to remember what we sang in this little Methodist church. And the first sort of when I discovered that I could find the chords and I could sing the song where I hadn't been allowed to really say goodbye to my father, you know, it was so quick. And I was too young to go to the mortuary and it wasn't appropriate. All those things that go with handling death.
Yes.
But somehow on the piano, I could sing my love and my grief. And that's the one place. But when I was 4 years old, my song was rooted. And this memory came very recently. I had a sister who was dying, a little baby who was born with a heart defect. And my mother, maybe that's when the drinking started to handle the pain and stuff. And she often used to say to me, please, Jennifer, just go lie next to Mary, and her name was, and just sing for her. Just please stop her crying. You know, all this like handling life and healthy kids and you've got a dying baby. And I remember lying next to my little sister and sort of the touch of the candlewick bedspread. You know, those here mumps where you run your lines, the color of it and the smell of this little baby and her blue sort of, and her struggling to breathe and me singing like my little child songs to her, but it was to help her. And I think that somewhere when I, you know, music not as a something to consume, but as something that heals. And out of the noise of our world today that's made music kind of a product.
Yeah.
How do we maintain that kind of very delicate and nuanced and also scary, because there's danger in that area when you're dealing with a reel in music. It's dangerous.
How do you manage to, as a creative, as Jennifer, and this is a general challenge for all creatives, but I want to know how you deal with it. On the one hand, you go to that scary deep place because the best creative output comes from a well of authenticity. And you make yourself vulnerable, you bring it to the surface in the lyrics. And at the same time, music and playing the piano, particularly if you're classically taught at first, you go into pop stuff, it's highly structured, it's mathematical, it's technical, you've got to play your scales, your arpeggios, and so and so, and you've got Ms. With a pencil wrapping you over the knuckles if you don't get it right. And it's just two different worlds, right? Because on the one hand, there's this incredible, deliberate, programmatic element to the journey of a musician.
Yeah.
And then there's the part which by the time you get to the back of the theater, it's supposed to just be Jennifer leaving her flow, and it's just supposed to be flowing. Do you think that's something that is just innate, or what was your journey to make the two come together? Because this your sound, just the melody alone and the use of your voice, there's a purity and clarity that is technically brilliant, quite apart from the effect that it has on me as a listener. And getting that correct can be very hard. Sometimes people are technically not very good, but you still feel them. You are feeling with them as they perform. And sometimes the other way around. Someone can be a brilliant technical musician, but just not move you at all. And you combine both. The track that we've just played is an example.
I mean, it's wonderful questions, because it's maybe the left brain and the right brain that we're talking about, just in how, you know, when one's doing the stuff. There are two things. The one thing that comes to me is, like, I had voice training, but in a way I had to throw out the teachers at some stage. I had the psychic, she was a psychic teacher, I'd say, in Heelbrow, when I was doing the hardcore sort of cabaret. Starting to sing at 1 in the night and literally often not having a voice, you know, hard. That was hard. It was hard training, that. But I had Norma Biaggi, and we just used to do this one exercise like over and over again. And she had these sort of 50 Abyssinian cats. But I realized she was kind of working energetically, so that when I left, I arrived with no voice, nothing. But half an hour later, I'd have a voice just from doing this one thing. So I can appreciate her now. But at some stage, it was in the Groot Mariko, about maybe 14, 15 years ago. I have some very good friends there. You could say they're kind of shamanic, if you had to put it politely. But the one's a professor of oboe of the Frankfurt Symphonic Orchestra, who's a Buddhist, but he comes to Groot Mariko, drops everything and just plays these atonal indigenous instruments, and we do overtones and stuff, but very... It's around a fire. We have fun. But it was around this fire. The other's a poet who lives up in the mountains a lot. My other friends, who's also an intuitive musician. You can call intuitive, improviser.
Those are the ones I was most jealous of.
Yeah, but this is where we're getting to now, because this improvisation and intuition. But the one night by a fire in Groot Mariko, I looked up. It was in the evening. I'd seen, maar nou gaan hulle regtig dink die vrou is regtig nou. It's like hippie stuff. But I really looked up on this berg that was surrounding the farm we lived on, and I saw the outline of, they were like Maasai warriors. I counted 15 standing on this horizon. And I mean, we were clear. We were clear. But it's a presence, and it's ancient root also of origin.
Yeah.
And around the fire that night, as we were singing, I suddenly found myself crouching next to the fire, and I started to sing in a way that I'd never sung before. And my voice opened. I can say that my range, you know, I got a 4-octave range from deep cave earth to sky high, and my natural voice came out, but it was because I was connected with nature. Stunning. And I was grounded, and I was in a gemeenskap, you know, it was a beautiful, at the same time when I'm singing, I do my warm-ups, I've got my breathing, I prepare myself. If you don't warm up, you're in trouble. But just to the final thing that I need to say about serving the moment. Everything in our lives, I believe, as musicians, as artists, when we are working with truth or authenticity, as you say, everything informs us to be present with us, to serve us at that moment when we perform.
Absolutely.
100%. So there's an alignment that consists, we come with everything that we have. We come with what is beyond what we can understand. And we also surrender our ego. Because the ego is the one that's saying, that was really good, or that was shit. You know, that kind of, where you're judging yourself. And a lot of classical music training is based on that kind of very strict evaluations that kills our inner child.
Absolutely. 24 minutes after 10. We're going to take a break here. And of course, if you are a musician, and as gifted as Jennifer, then there's something totalizing in your approach towards the justice question. The arts in this country don't get their rightful place in the annals of political history. But nevertheless, she crosses over, because she crosses over into the political arena as well. And on the other side of this, we're going to talk about her journey formally into politics, her activism. And of course, once you are in the political arena, which is a toxic masculine space, you deal with comrades that share politics with you. but you sometimes encounter comrades who are as dedicated as you are in the fight against white supremacy and racism, but some of them stop there and are misogynistic in respects that can catch you unawares. Jennifer, so you have this musical talent, this gift. You see these weird things in the out there.
I didn't mean to tell you that.
You get this incredible range. You know, it's stunning. Why on earth enter the political arena? When did, how did that come about?
I mean, my engagement with politics was also visceral, you can say. And I often say, you know, the first act was when I came home, because I grew up in a conservative white family. My groot oom, Tom Nudia, was acting state president.
Wow.
My father, I think, voted UP. But, you know, I was, it was a lonely journey, but I love to read. And this thing of books, and I really can just encourage books, like real books. But finding a book on World War II, coming home to my mom, whose father was German, came from Germany, her mother, French Huguenots, so been in the country, like 400 years, 300 years, and Huguenots that had left because of persecution in Europe. Nordia. And asking her these pictures of Auschwitz and Belsen and Dachau, little small black and white pictures, and her sort of looking on some level at them and starting to explain how the Jews had stolen the German land. And, you know, that thing, I really name it as that was my dawn of political consciousness somewhere, because it was the first time I really encountered what was a fabricated, distorted truth being fed to me from my parental authority, but the contradiction and the blatant contradiction that I could read, and there was no ways I could meet those two worlds, and it instilled in me, besides my whole sort of journey within the family, but a necessary mistrust of the zeitgeist of the world as it was being presented to me. And I thank her for that, because it prompted me to look deeper and go to school earlier, read the Rand Daily Mail. So even though we got the star, but I'd go early to school. I loved reading. And even though she confiscated some of the books that I was reading, well-intended, because they had sex. Sex wasn't the problem. We were living in a distorted world that was based on racism.
Absolutely.
So out of that, you know, and of course, I wanted to study law, did Latin at school. Helen Suzman then was the kind of who I could identify with. Ironically, the Slovos were living down the road. I didn't know that. But out of I was the eldest, you know, so I was pioneering, but also fighting with a lot of conflict at home around ideas. But at university, I was fortunate, started with journalism, actually. Met Harvey Tyson. I got in cadet school for the Star, and he said to me, if you can go to university, Jennifer, do it. Got bursaries. Went to university, decided to change to UCT because of their drama school, and I loved the theater, and it felt like a really dynamic environment. Moved there, and political student politics, you know, engaged. Thank God for that.
Absolutely.
Thank God for that.
Okay, let's take a bit of a break here.
Your CBS Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
We're hanging out with Jennifer Ferguson, and I wish I could hang out with her the whole day.
She's so
cool.
So much.
But I suspect from now on, we're already best friends forever.
Always.
I can just feel
it. Always, absolutely.
When you were an MP,
yeah.
Okay. She's chuckling. She knows where this is going. You got into all sorts of trouble because you're a very principled person. Big debates around women's rights, for example, abortion rights. And as an MP, you said that you had felt on this particular matter unable to reduce the complexity of the issue into a mere choice of two buttons. I was searching for the third way, the one that could compassionately embrace both mother and child. I know many of my colleagues were in a similar dilemma. A neighborly comrade held my hand and said, press the yes button, my darling, and go home and pray to God. I was unable to vote without conscience, and I abstained. Yeah. Just talk to me about that, because now you are in Parliament, and suddenly this wonderful individual, authentic musician gets introduced to things called strict line whips, for example.
Exactly.
How was that like?
I mean, it was very difficult, say, around the song issue as well. I mean, I really wanted to sing. And actually, I had a song written by Brecht, Bertolt Brecht, on abortion, the Ballad of Marie A., because it took so long for the abortion legislation to come up. And I wanted to sing this ballad in Parliament, Brecht. But then I got my chief whip saying, no account are you allowed to sing. You will lower the tone of the Parliament. And now if we're witnessing what's happening, you know, and what has been happening, we allow heckling and we allow, it's become a complete circus. But just to get to this very delicate issue, because I am not anti-abortion. And my position, you could say formally and politically, is one of pro-life feminism. But what I was trying to do in a language that was very difficult to find or to articulate within is say, how do we legislate for the abortion of female fetuses, for example? How do we legislate to protect that choice? How do we legislate to also allow an engaged father, to be a participant in that decision? How do we legislate to really empower the woman that she feels, I can have the child alone and I've got enough? So we're talking about that gray area of nuance that so many of these delicate areas of human interrelationship, including our sexual interrelating, resides. It's this enormously complex area. And we try and reduce into sort of Roman Dutch. We got our Roman Dutch legal system based on reason and rational conclusions, rooted in patriarchal thinking. And we're trying to sort of fit these very delicate areas. And this abstention was an act of political disobedience. But there was absolutely no choice for me there. And especially if I felt I was being intimidated, as many of us felt, there was not sufficient discussion. We had no place. I went to the chief whip of 3 times to try and raise this issue with him. I wasn't met. So in the end, as an artist, you've only got your conscience. And you've got to be able to say, am I standing straight in the space or not? Am I going to be bent? My spine is going to be double bent. I better get out before I die of migraines.
Politics is inherently patriarchal.
Yes.
It's praxis.
Yes.
The texture, the number of men that are involved, everything about it. And it's not surprising because it is obviously part of, rather than adjacent to, society at large. Yeah. What was it like having to share space with folks whose politics coincide with yours on the major questions in terms of racial justice?
Yes.
But not in terms of an intersectional approach towards justice that also cares deeply about questions of class and gender, for example.
Very difficult. I can say the biggest challenge resided in the caucus, in our own caucus, in ANC caucus. And so this thing of, as much as I met individually and personally some extraordinary, extraordinary human beings, Marlydia of Trek, for example, a woman illiterate, she wasn't, but she was there as a representative. She was the one who burst out spontaneously with, holy la la, as Madiba walked in and the comrades around her going, shh, shh, shh. Because we'd been told this is Westminster Parliament and we're going to lower the tone. So there was a frustration that we were culturally also compromising. And I'm not talking about unruly and childish expression of behavior or expression of violence, which we're witnessing a lot in the Parliament today. I think you can hold dignified and respectful communication based on the principle of respectful listening and accommodation of differences. But if we don't have the space for the conversation to happen and we have intimidation and fear driving the process, it's a very unhealthy environment.
Okay, let's speed up the conversation a little bit before we run out of time. You coming back to South Africa coincides with a range of things. International Women's Day. Tomorrow we talk about Human Rights Day in South Africa. This is the 100th year would have been of Madiba in terms of his birth. It is a wonderful opportunity for stock taking. And it's important that we don't go into an existential crisis every single time life Isidimeni happens, Marikana happens, a pit latrine that a child falls into. And yet at the same time, it's also important to self-examine. How do you feel about the country of your birth and where it's at in terms of that normative vision of Madiba's government that you were a part of and where we are at in 2018?
I think the whole world, where we're at, is we're part of a global reality, really. And the need for engaged activism, I think, is more so than ever. We are living with an enormous access to information. How do we sift out critically what's true and what's not true? So this thing of me coming back now to make music, and then Baxter invited me, Baxter Theatre, 4th to the 7th of April, only for concerts. You've got to book because the tickets are going. And Mpumalanga with a...
This
thing of, for every atrocity, to create something beautiful and life affirmative and empowering, I'm hoping that we've got an opportunity in some way to engage in that. And I come here really in a spirit of deep listenership, and I have to emphasize that, because I don't think there's any one strategy for us. I think there's very exciting things happening in terms of on the ground, where people are feeling mobilized. Maybe we needed a polarizing thing like a Zuma figure to get all of us together, because his ethos, the ethos of racism and racist thinking, racist formulations that has crept back into the society, very dangerous.
Yeah.
Very, very dangerous.
Talk to me about what it is like to have to deal with a comrade that preys on you, that rapes you, when you thought that there's a morally, minimally level of decency that you can take for granted in people that you are in the struggle with.
I mean, the fact that it took me 24 years to come out of this, come out with a story and come out of it, to free myself, first of all, but also to be able to apologize to other women who I think have been possibly affected by his behavior, to take responsibility for that. But at the same time, my whole process has been about taking what is my story. You can say the whimper of the white woman that sort of gets attention, but the screams of black women, a million screams, doesn't get attention. How do I deal with that? So my sense of taking my Me Too, this extraordinary moment in time, which we want to keep as a momentum, an extraordinary global momentum for women to disclose in order to heal themselves. Me Too is about the survivor, not the perpetrator as such. So We Too is trying to take the hashtag We Too for the series of concerts I'm doing, is to trying to take my personal unspeakable story into a much bigger perspective, and to address what are the systemic sicknesses that is allowing the continuation of it. And we're talking generations. That man is also a wounded comrade. He's a wounded comrade.
It's amazing to me how the public, men and women, ask stupid questions, but stupid questions that are important to interrogate if one has the strength to do so for teaching purposes. A lot of people were deeply moved by your courage when you spoke out last year. Then there were also people who said, "Malcolm, it's so long, but why did you take so long?" I know why you took so long. I took a long time before I talked about being raped as a teenage boy, as a little boy, not even a teenager, as a preteen. Can you articulate to the public why sometimes it takes decades before a survivor speaks their truth?
It's because this whole thing lies in this gray area that we've been talking about, where it's so deeply personal and so deeply loaded with your own sense of shame, that in order to speak out about it takes a kind of breaking away from your family. I had to do this in a way on my own when I spoke out. I had to do it. It was my own journey. It took a kind of a mad courage, but there's been enormous fallout. The people around me, closest to me, affected, men around me, good friends. You know, it's the whole thing has been kind of shaken, and I assume that the comrade himself in his own family, because to speak truth about this thing, when you know that 24 years ago there was no ways that you could, you were not able to. You can go into the terrible thing that happens with rape, where there's a freeze, a traumatic kind of paralysis that comes, that makes you to go to a police station. And I've written some text, you know, which is, I'm working on the song now. It's like, how do I jiffy seal my panties in a plastic bag? Do I go to a police station to talk to somebody who's not going to believe me? What do I say? I don't even know his name for sure. I don't know his surname. I don't even know his surname. And when that happened, the day it happened, the morning after this had happened, the early morning hours, when I found myself walking on the shores of Port Elizabeth and having the small group of Zionist worshippers, these holy African people, take me, welcome me into the sea, and I was blessed with a ritual in the water of cleansing. That thing for me was the most important. At that time, how, you know, if I take the police station and my sort of need to lay charge, and then it wasn't feasible for me. We were going into elections. This man had power. I was a brain man.
Do you have any idea how you might react if you leave this building and you see Danny Yordan outside?
I've been waiting for him to make contact with me. In my heart of hearts, in the 2 weeks, especially after I came out with naming him, I've been waiting for him to make personal contact with me, not a wall of lawyers, not a strategy. I've left that door open. I still leave the door open because I believe our whole TRC process, our country has been committed to finding different ways. The legal systems fail us. The legal system will not serve the survivor of rape. That is the reality. If you've got money and you've got power, the legal system will serve you. And as it stands, I'm vulnerable in that, but I'm strong in my truth. So I'm strong on stage. I'm strong in what I can hold. But when I go into courts of law where it's already swayed towards those in power, and especially financial power, having expensive teams of lawyers, a civil action case, if I lose, I'm liable for all expenses. I'm very vulnerable. I have not given up on the option of a civil court. I can say that now.
You don't need me to say this, but for what it's worth, I believe you.
Thank you.
Danny Yordan is a rapist.
I mean, we hold the story in as much as we can be in our truth. And I pray for, I did a 10-day retreat, a silent retreat, which was very important for me, not talking, far away from everybody, meditation, deep. And during that time, I prayed. And I asked for forgiveness, that I could forgive him 100% as a human being. I asked for guidance, how I could act in a political social justice activist, how I could take action aligned with the millions of other women in that similar situation, and as an artist, how could
Absolutely.
I meet that?
Well, we'll take a break on that point. And the law is a difficult beast to meet here, because he is not guilty in law, but the law is not the final arbiter on actual truth. There's legal truth and there's truth.
Eusebius McKaiser on your number one news and talk station.
And of course, this commitment to justice on the part of Jennifer Ferguson, you find continues in her work, in her music, such as this Street Child Lullaby for Frida Darvel, who from the streets taught her about the stars. Wonderful hour, time just flies. And of course, Jennifer, I sadly will have to say goodbye to her in 5 minutes. I just have one or two questions I want to ask her, and then to also do some little bit of a chat about wine factories here in the country, and where you might be able, if you are lucky to get one of the last tickets, to be able to catch her. A couple of people caught onto something you said as you described that horror that you had experienced, Jennifer, and you were talking about the brain man. What did you mean by that?
In our clumsy and complex designations of definition in our country, we are still sitting with the residue of how of to see each other as one people. And so I use that term with great I can say it's crude.
Yeah.
And it doesn't fall lightly on my tongue. My son is a brain man, by definition of this world. But as a humanist and as a somebody on a spiritual path who's really striving to see just the core of our humanity, that we are one blood, as our Prophet Mali would say, we are one blood. But the politics, unfortunately, designates us, and we play those kind of games when we play those cards and we are caught in those kind of definitions, whether we like it or not.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And of course, the history of our country. I have a slave woman in my, you know, 400 years ago, a slave woman from Benin. But the root of our country in the terms of the so-called brown designation is rooted in rape. And we're dealing with that. And we are trying to see if we can't also find the capacity of self-acceptance and forgiveness that goes with that. You know, we lost. We just perpetrate ourselves.
And there are other layers here that we'll talk about when we next have a conversation, which is that one invites all sorts of spurious critiques of one's own story of surviving rape. Such as, for example, the fact that black men and brain money are so often in society pathologized for hypersexuality that an added burden one has to speak out.
Exactly.
And it's not to say that it's easier to speak out against a white man, but so many things come over you. It's also like, will I be yet another white liberal feminist that is seen to be pathologizing brain-o-sexuality?
In a time where we committed, and that was that wave that said, if we can't do this together, you know, and that was 94, we had to do it together.
Absolutely.
We still have to do it together.
Yeah.
We still have to do it together, because if we divide on these levels, we're going to have chaos.
And at the same time, it's important to call each other out as comrades.
Exactly.
I can recognize that Jennifer may be absolutely brilliant in her commitment towards fighting poverty, but she may be horrible on the question of gender.
Right.
Eusebius may be excellent on the question of sexual orientation. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, he has horrible attitudes towards poor people.
Yeah.
And we need to hold each other accountable.
That's
Why are
nice.
You in the country? The hashtag MeToo went viral, and it has sort of become a beautiful example of digital activism.
Yeah.
And you are here at the Baxter Theatre Centre in partnership with Piece of Music and the Forgotten Angle Theatre Collaborative. It's a family affair.
Everybody, welcome. It is absolutely
stunning. I wonder if I can find an excuse to be in Cape Town.
Come.
Talk to us a little bit about why you're here.
Oh, it's beautiful. We've elevated MeToo into hashtag WeToo. And it's going to be a beautiful concert. Zolani Mahula is going to be playing on 4th of April. There are not many tickets left. And this thing of rising, you know, how do we lift ourselves and remember what is our glory? We've got singers from Khayelitsha, we've got Cape Town Youth Choir, vocal ensemble. There's going to be a dense gathering of voices and beautiful songs, I think, that not only look into the past, that will also touch on what happened, but that empower us and create a sense of we can.
Well, you can try your luck and go to webtickets.co.za, see whether you can get one of the last ones. This is incredibly important. It is music. It's entertainment. It is the stunning voice of Jennifer's that you've heard. And without being literal about it, Jennifer, it is, as a lot of your music has been, also a part of narrative justice.
Exactly. Beautiful, beautiful phrase that. It gives us an opportunity to engage, really, but in a way that also empowers and enlightens us, enlightens, creates a collective. And I'm also going to be at Millie's, just close to where I was born. I was born in Ermelo.
In Ermelo. We all have a past, darling. We all have a past.
Ek was geboren in Ermelo, in Mashadedorp.
You are only responsible for what you do after you were born, not for having been born.
I can't help it, and I escaped. But I love that area, and they're doing great work, the Forgotten Angle
when are you there?
Collaborative. On the 23rd. The 23rd, Friday, at Millie's, Nochal, by the Celtics.
I can't guarantee that die mense van Ermelo luister na 702, but in the event that they are, that's where you can catch your home
girl. Welcome down in Mililand, the cultural heartland, cultural heartland of Mpumalanga.
I'm going to give you a minute, just a final thought, whatever you want to say. I'm just in awe of how you have done this musical thing.
Yeah.
It's going to be brilliant at the Baxter.
Yeah.
Those tickets will be gone within the next hour, the remaining three or four.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you've managed to make sure that despite the flip side of digital activism yeah. is getting trolled,
yeah.
getting doubted,
yeah.
conspiracy theories, and your spirit and your humanity is still very much intact.
Yeah.
Some final thoughts.
I can just say that when I talk about underneath the sort of noise and stuff, but I have a deep sense of peace. And I have a real belief that South Africa, our gift of our humanity, is what is our strongest wealth.
Mm.
And I believe that all the crises and the shit that we have to face and that we've got to deal here, it is making us strong. But if we can just pause for a moment and see, can I hear that person really without trying to just counter, without trying to fight? Let me try and listen, try and understand, and also let me surrender and ask for the power greater than ourselves to guide us and help us.
Thank you. And the freedom to not have to say the word excrement. Honestly, she's the guest. We didn't say it. But an absolutely wonderful hour and 10, 15 minutes. Thank you so much for making time for us, and
thank
all the
you,
best.
Darling. Thank you so much, all of you. Thank you, all of you.